But if I were an African, it may even be worse. Now, let me just illustrate one illustration of the problem that it is of communicating. When I first came to Australia, to America, I went to visit a friend of mine, and they had a very nice, lovely little child. And I came up to the lady and I said, "Oh, that's a lovely little baby. Very sweet. Would you mind if I nursed it?" He said, "What kind of a man are you?" It took a little while for me to explain what nursing meant in Australia, which didn't help very much. That was relationships. And so then I said, "Well, you know, if you don't want me to, you can stick it up your jumper." And she looked at me. And I said, apparently said something wrong again, you know. You have to understand that nursing in Australia simply means that you rock the baby, you hold it in your arms and say, "Kitchy, kitchy, coo." And to stick it up your jumper means, this is a jumper, sweater, or something like that, means put it in your pocket, forget it, or don't worry, you know, you can keep it. But jumper means something else in this company. She never did tell me what it meant. So every once in a while, you have to allow for things. The other introductory thing I want to mention is that I have not yet ever heard anybody who has enough intestinal fortitude to tackle the book of Daniel outside of a seminary lecture. And so, I would like to get an idea of how many of you have heard somebody within recent years discuss the book of Daniel? A small number. Was it in the congregational setting? Was it a university setting? Or a seminary setting? Or, you know, college setting? How many of you have heard it outside of a college setting or a university setting? It's getting smaller. And so, I guess a lot of you probably don't know very much about Daniel. And a lot of, as it indicates, people are just scared to talk about it because of the difficulty of understanding this world. Now, I'm going to start off with some experiments. I tend to do that. And since it's the first time I've ever done it in public outside of the seminary situation too, this also may create certain interesting features. It will be interesting to see your reaction to the experiment that we want to start here. We still have a seat over here. Come right around there. You can sit. In fact, we've got two over here. You can also sit on the tape recorder if you want to. You think this is loud enough? You think you'll pick it up all right? Whoever's taping this. This may be a historic moment. Maybe the last time I ever teach Daniel. All right. Experiment works like this. I'm going to put certain things on the board. I'm going to ask. And I want you to be honest. I want you to take your masks off if you can, as much as you can. That doesn't have to be completely, but enough to answer these questions as we put them on the board. We'll divide this into two parts. Now I'm going to ask you, how many of you, number one, how many of you think you're breaking up here. It's terrible, sure. I'll write it again. How many of you live your days and think very frequently about the end of the age or the end of the world? How many of you feel that this is right around the corner? Enough. Okay. How many of you How many of you operate with the idea that, well, God is talking about, think about the needs of now, rather than of the end of the age, concerned about the end of the age? This is much more concerned to you. You rarely think about the end of the age, all right? This gives me a pretty big, much bigger group this time. All right? The next one is, I want to put this timeline on the board first. This is a timeline from creation to the end of the world. Okay? The whole span of history. How many of you think that, how many of you believe that history is divided into very definite periods, very definite stages, and that, there are two sides to this, some of you may in a general way like Toynbee think about periods, How many of you think that the world is divided into stages and that all of this plan of history was all pre-planned back in eternity? That God set up the plan of history before it all started?
Hand up.
One. I'll be honest, one way or the other. Now I'll give the alternative, I suppose. Right? The other alternative is not that this was all pre-planned and pre-fixed, but that I, living here at this point, see history as being, the word we use, I'll put it on the board, history as contingent. I'll explain that word. Right, this is the one slide here. Pre-planned, and I guess the key word, simple word, that is that there's a blueprint. All right? Now, that the history is contingent. That is that when man does something, or when circumstances change as time goes along, then the course of history changes. That if a prophet comes along and says a certain word, and everybody repents, then what seemed to be happening will change. That history is contingent and dependent upon the circumstances, the kind of people that arise, the kind of change of operations that happen from time to time. History is contingent, or is it fixed? So that there's a very definite thing that God has planned to have happen, stage by stage.
God is still in control?
Yeah, God is still operating in it, but it's not a fixed plan. How many of you think of history as pre-planned and fixed at the beginning, or how many of you operated with the thing as being changeable, and that if you do a certain thing, you can change the course of history? Who takes the first one? I'm going to have to set these alternatives up. You can either abstain from voting, or you can... Now, I grant that some of you might say, well, I have a sort of a half of one and half of the other. I've got to set up these alternatives in order to make the thing come out understandable. How many of you are generally favor the idea that everything is fixed and planned? All right? How many of you generally favor the other position? Very strong. Okay? That's sort of interesting. Now let me put it this way. How many of you operate with the idea that when you go back to the Bible, that the men of God, like Moses, Jeremiah, etc., look ahead to predict the end and what's happening? What's going to happen? The future, and especially the end time. Or how many of you operate on a different basis, that Jeremiah, well, we'll put another name here, Isaiah at this time, is not concerned about predicting to the end time what's going to happen, but is primarily concerned about preaching to the situation and the needs of here and now. So we have on this side, the primary role is to preach, or is it primarily to predict what's going to happen according to some plan of God? Who operates with the idea of the prophets as people who predict? Hand up. How many of you operate with the prophets as people who preach? Okay. Very interesting. All right. You don't know where you're going yet. All right. Now let's put the other thing, put the question this way. How many of you operate? Now there may be, of course, notice that I'm talking about the major emphasis. And it's not denying that there may be some prediction here, or that the man who predicts isn't also, to some extent, talking to an immediate needs. But the major emphasis I'm talking about. All right? Now I'm going to do my shirt for the next one. How many of you operate with the idea, when you think about the Old Testament prophets, that Jeremiah or Isaiah doesn't understand everything that he's talking about in terms of the future, because they all have something about the future, doesn't understand it completely? Or how many of you operate with the idea that this guy who's preaching knows exactly what he's saying? Those who would start on this point and say, they don't always understand everything, that the meaning of this is interpreted later, what they were saying, by another prophet, or an angel, or by Christ. They didn't really always understand what they were saying. How many of you operate with the idea that the prophet or the preacher, whoever it was, did not always fully understand what he was talking about. All that, he knew exactly what I wanted to say, the situation, that it was completely clear. How many had to take the first? Well, and those who took the second one, that he knows exactly what he's understanding. Okay? Huh? All right, now I'm saying, does he understand what he's talking about? That is completely clear. Can he understand what he's talking about? Does he understand what his words mean and so on? All right, since you answered this one this way, I'm going to follow down here. How many of you would say that if it's true that he doesn't understand all of the things that he says, therefore, a lot of the things that he talks about are really symbols of something else then. That I use a symbol that has a hidden meaning in it. A symbol with a hidden meaning. Or are they, on the other side of the balance here, images that are completely well understood, completely clear images that simply illustrate or put some more punch to it? Or are they symbols with a hidden meaning? How many will now say, all right, when I go to look at the read the prophets now, I'm going to look for things that he didn't understand, find the symbols, and find what the meaning was behind it all that he didn't know about. Hand up those who do that when they go to the prophets then. Find the symbols and find the hidden meaning behind the prophets. Hand up. All right, how many go out at this and say, no, I don't look for symbols or hidden meanings at all? Do the second one. Alright. May not like my alternatives, but don't tell me that. Alright. How many of you don't worry about this. This is very important, this point, to understand what we're going to do. How many of you now will say, alright, I'm gonna have a sort of a sub line under this one. How many of you operate with the idea that, well, there are certain things that are lucky, like lucky numbers. Certain numbers have special meaning. How many of you operate, by the way? Anybody? No. Any of you operate with the idea of horoscopes? That then maybe there's something in the star. Anyone? No. Not anybody. All right, be honest. I'm telling you, be honest. All right. We put down here not only symbols and sound, but also we put down numbers as being lucky and all the rest of it, you see? This is all part of this picture on the one side. Now, how many of you operate with the idea when you come to the prophets that these are first and foremost, or when you come to the biblical books, that they are first and foremost either literary, they are literary documents, namely that the man has sat down to write, or that they are oral, that is sermons that have been collected, that were first spoken orally, and then later on somebody else collected and put down. How many of you think that the prophets sits down and writes out a material and preserves it for posterity primarily? That he is primarily a writer rather than a preacher. How many take the idea that the prophet is a writer, first of all, primarily? A preacher. Okay? Now I'm going to start moving a slightly different area. It sort of is about halfway on this thing. Now I'm going to ask the question, don't forget the sermon until we get to the end of the pack, and then I'll be able to focus it. Then you can follow me as much as you like. Now, how many of you operate with the idea that in this world in which we live, there are evil forces which you understand as being evil beings? And that these evil beings in the world, demons, whatever you want to call them, evil beings, evil forces, have an effect on the world and on you and on people. How many of you operate with the idea of evil beings in the world around you? Hand up. How many of you operate without them? Okay.
Supernatural?
Yes, supernatural beings. Supernatural beings.
I mean,
here on this side, you would not talk about evil beings, but just simply evil people. All right? Evil people over against, and then, sure, on this side, they're both evil beings and evil people. But that whether I know evil beings, you have to see the kind of the forces of evil in terms of evil people. The people are the ones at fault. All right, let's go one step back on this evil being bit. How many of you say, then, that the source of all evil is in one specific evil being, namely the devil? How many of you operate with that idea? Hand up. The source of all evil ultimately goes back to the devil. How many of you operate with the idea that the source of evil... that the cause for all evil, the fault of all evil, lies not with an evil being, a free, but with man himself? The devil or with man? Okay, now we're starting to split half and half. All right? Now, let me get this a little bit clearer. How many of you now operate, will move from the evil beings to the good beings? How many of you operate with the idea that, we'll call them angels because this is the term that you operate with, that God, on the other side of the fence, will have to put... women? Funny how people think of angels as being female very often. Of course, if you read Ezekiel, they turn out to be animals. Rule that angels are forces which rule, or on the other side, that they are simply reflections of God's presence and... I'll explain what I mean by this. Here is the great timeline. Here is the world. I'll have to put it down here. And God is up here. And in between God and the world, God uses angels and heavenly beings as the powers through which he rules the world, as forces through which he governs and directs and orders things. Or do you conceive of these as simply being, somehow or another, that which is the glory of God, that which surrounds God, beings that merely exalt God? Or are they operating forces, powers that God uses to rule the world? A, those that angels as forces that rule the world. Hand up. Those who take the second one. All right? All right, we're starting to split you up. Nicely, 50-50. Having done that, we will probably end up with a nice divided whole village here eventually. And it's interesting how you see...
We're
going to
be splintered.
Splintered, yes, that's right. That's also a part of it, too, is interesting to help you see how not everybody puts his emphases the same way as someone else. And most people don't like to use this technique because it embarrasses the instructor because he doesn't know where to go after he's finished. All right. Now, how many of you operate with the idea of the end of the world as being the destruction of this whole universe, that the whole thing will melt, that all these trees and mountains and everything will disappear? For the sake of this particular thing. Or how many of you operate with the idea of the end as being a day of punishment on God's people? Now you probably look at that and say, ooh, gee, it's an easy decision, is it?
What do you mean by God's people?
Those with whom God... Oh, we'll just call mankind.
A day of punishment on mankind? Or is this a very difficult alternative for you?
Let me just... you can answer yes to both of these if you want it. Or no to both of them. How do you operate with the idea of the total disintegration of this world with the trees and everything else?
I think
All I'm asking is whether you happen to believe that this is probable. See, I'm not saying you have to be even committed to some of these. Probable. Well, how do you operate with the idea of the idea of God's punishment as a day of doom as being specially related to the people of that God operates with, rather than the physical universe. Hannah.
All right, that's interesting. That's interesting that in modern society, that in our Lutheran church, people would say that.
I didn't expect as many yeses on that. All right? Let's put the next question. How many of you operate with the idea that when the world, when there is this day of punishment, we'll have to move over here now, 11, that this will be, that for those who are the evil, there will be hell, and that hell will be a place of fire and punishment, a place of great fire and destruction and tremendous suffering? Or, on the other side of the fence, how many of you operate with the idea of simply everybody ending in death, and that death is just simply oblivion in terms of God's punishment, that God simply will, if he wants to punish somebody, he will either give him some chastisement, or that he will simply die, and the death is oblivion. How many of you see, actually believe that hell now is a place of fire and punishment? Or how many of you have modified this so that you think in terms of death rather than, or of separation from God or oblivion rather than an actual hell of fire? All right, separate. All right, all right. We've got to get the antithesis sharp in your mind that you understand. I have a word that means something to me, and you may not see the same meaning. All right, those who see hell in terms of a fire and a punishment, completely now. All right, those who take the other position.
Separation.
Separation. Death, separation.
No.
Punishment are a totally different set. Alright? Now let's take the next one. For the good people. For those people who are the saints. Those who are the believers. How many of you operate with the idea that when God brings his punishment upon the world, that there are certain saints, we call them in biblical term the righteous remnant, that will not receive his punishment? Or do you operate with the idea that when God comes to punish the people of God, that is, those who believe as well as anybody else, are under judgment and will receive punishment?
What's that last one?
In terms of the coming age, as the world comes to an end and the day of punishment arises and God's punishment begins to come down upon mankind, which is a common concept in the Bible, and most of you, of course, probably think there is a punishment, but this is, I'm talking about your understanding now of the end time. As the end approaches, all right, how many of you get the idea that the punishment will be spared for the saints, but the people of God, on the other side of it will be for all people. The people of God especially are the ones that will receive God's punishment. Especially. Before the end of the world, right? I'm just backtracking just a section. I need to say this because I've got to get this concept of the saints. Are the saints immune from God's punishment before the world ends? Yes?
And who are the saints again?
Those people who are God's elect, God's saved ones, God's pure ones.
You mean ones who accept him as their savior?
Well, let's just assume for the moment that you think of yourselves as the saints. All right? You're the elect. You're baptized. You belong to God. All right? Do you think that as the end approaches, you're going to be free from the punishment of God? And of those who think, yes.
What kind of punishment?
Well, all kinds. Any kind. The problem here is, of course, the great diversity of possibilities. All right, let's put it this way.
Now?
Right now. Anytime now. You're going to be free from this punishment? Yes. No. No. All right. Wait, I'll show you what this means and the problem of this particular diversity in a moment. Next, how many of you believe that when the end does come now, instead of, if you are one of these saints, that is one of the believers, those who believe in God, you believe that you will all be resurrected and everybody will be resurrected, and especially the saints will be resurrected, those of you who believe, and will be given a special privilege before God, that you'll be a resurrection of all people. And of those who believe in the resurrection of all people to start up.
Resurrection of all people.
I know the alternative. I was going to throw this one out before the alternative. I'll put the alternative over here, that you simply recognize death and say nothing, or know nothing, or believe nothing, actually, about what's going to happen afterwards.
And you shut up on the last line of the creed.
Yes, you shut up on the last line of the creed. Yes, that's right. How many of you really, so when you say the last line of the creed, don't really say it? I mean, in your heart, you say, I don't really know what's going to happen after death. I'll leave it to God.
Well, why can't you say that in the creed and still leave it to God? I mean, if you don't.
But I'm going to say, you're saying it in the sense, are you saying in the sense that you actually believe that you're going to be raised from the dead and that you're going to be given a new form and all the rest of it? Where is it? I believe in the resurrection of the body. Right?
I believe in it.
All right, this is the picture that's there. Do you believe in the resurrection of the body, or do you just leave this as a, say, I'm going to die, I'm going to leave it as a question mark, I don't really know, I don't really believe anything, I just, I'm not sure. Let's just take this one, resurrection. Who believes in the actual resurrection of the body? Who believes they don't know the answer? They don't believe anything about this. Okay? Now...
Hey, sister, I really still understand.
No, I didn't ask you whether I believe in the life after death. I asked you whether I believe you believe in the resurrection.
And the second alternative to believe that we may or may not, but we're just...
I'm not saying anything about whether you exist after death. I said explicitly resurrection. That's a different thing than eternal life. You have eternal life right now, says Paul, says John, in the sense that you belong to Christ and all the rest of it. And so my emphasis here was to underscore resurrection.
The other one, I'm just saying, leaving
it a big question mark, what happens in terms of how of whatever happens after death. Huh? All right?
Yeah, I didn't understand.
Okay. My term was precise here when I said resurrection. Okay? One more thing, and then we're finished with this little game. How many of you believe now that the new age, after you're resurrected, there is going to be a place called heaven, and that in this place there will be supreme bliss and joy and everything else. A transformed idea of a new heaven and a new, like the prophets, a new heaven and new earth, where everything is going to be glorious. There's going to be a new Jerusalem sort of picture where everything is just supreme joy. Or do you believe on the other side of the fence that when it talks about the new age, and when we talks about the new coming of the kingdom and the parousia and the coming of our Lord, that this coming is not to be understood in terms of another world, a transcendental world, but of a kingdom on earth? Is it a heavenly one or an earthly one? Where do you stand? The new age is a transformation of the world in which we live right now. Or is it a world of heaven, and is it another world, the world totally alien, different from this kind of world in which we live now? Who takes the first one? Who takes the second? All right? And if you don't have to, you don't have to answer any of these, as I said. Now, let me just cut it off. I realize that in some cases the alternatives may have been a little bit hard for you to follow. Don't worry about that. But if, on the majority of cases, you answered in number one, if on the majority of cases you answered on this side, you were, there's no place to put it on top, you were following the position of apocalyptic. If you answered on this side, you were following the position of the prophets. These represent the major tensions, the major differences between the tradition which we call apocalyptic, or the theology or the teaching that we call apocalyptic on the one side, and the arm that we call prophets on the other side. Now, the prophets come into the picture all through the history of God's people up until the time of the intertestamental period. And this major emphasis is an emphasis that's primarily in the period after the prophets. Now let me explain this with a diagram over here. I'll erase this one and show you briefly the difference between prophet and apocalyptic. The word apocalyptic means that which is revealed, a hidden meaning revealed, a secret revealed through some kind of symbol, some kind of vision. That's the simplest meaning that I can give for you that word. But it also comes to stand for this total position, this total emphasis, where it is tends to be the mysterious, the otherworldly side of it, whereas this emphasizes the this-worldly somewhat more. This is a very general observation. Now let me take this picture again, this timeline. Here is the timeline from creation to the end. The apocalyptist, we have to call him that because I don't know a better name, the man who writes apocalyptic visions, is a man who is living, he believes, right before the end. There he is, a for the apocalyptist. And for him, the end is the total end and the complete change of this particular age. And
yes, would Paul somewhat fit into that then?
Well, we get some passages of Paul.
Yeah, he was saying that just very shortly now it's going to come to the end.
Yeah. The question is, what does he mean by the end? And what happened? All right, maybe you're right. We can look at Paul a little bit later if you want to make the parallel. All right, and that the new age that is going to come is not like the historical age at all, but it is otherworldly, or as we would call it, heaven. That is not like this age in which we live now. The prophets, on the other hand, I'm talking about this timeline and the end, are living at a certain point, and when they talk about the end, they don't talk about the annihilation of this age. They talk about the end of the people of God, that God is going to bring his wrath upon them, and they start again. They don't think of a heaven come down to earth. They think of God changing what's happened now and starting again, but always within the cycle of history. Now, this apocalyptic writer who believes he lives right at the end time also believes that as the end approaches, things get more and more and more evil, and that the persecution of this group which he represents, in which he lives, namely the saints, that is, the very righteous handful that are left behind. All the rest of the world has gone to pot, but he hasn't, and his group are the saints. They are the righteous few, the remnant, that handful that are left behind, and he is their spokesman. Now, he doesn't simply say, all right, I am apocalyptic Annie, and I live right at this time. In order to underscore that he knows that the end time is something that has been pre-planned for a long time, he claims to be somebody back here. Let's just take one typical great apocalyptic writer. His name is Enoch. Enoch. This writer doesn't say, I am X or A. He says, I'm Enoch. And I, Enoch, had a vision. And the vision was such that I could see everything that is going to happen during the cycles of history that precede. Because for the apocalyptic writer, everything has a blueprint in heaven. It's all pre-planned. It's all fixed from eternity. Here is the blueprint of history, written in the heavenly books, or the heavenly tablets, or all variety of other names that are given to it. And all of this is common in the intertestamental writings, all over the place. And now this writer looks at these. He says, I can see each one of the ages, A, B, C, D, E. And he carefully spans out which are the periods of time that are going to be. And of course, he can tell you them very easily because he's lived after they've happened. He has no problem doing it because he's not really predicting in the sense that he's looking ahead. He simply is claiming this. But in the spirit of Enoch, as though he were Enoch living at this time, he says what he believes Enoch would have said and seen as he looks ahead to the future. And for his writers, then they understand, all right, he knows the cycle of history. And if the number is a symbolic number, say there are seven ages, which is a holy number, a sacred number, the people are living in the seventh age, and hence in the final age, right before the great cataclysmic end, when everything will be upheaval and God will bring in the new age. And these saints who have been persecuted will finally be vindicated, and all the pure will be resurrected from the dead and be able to live in the new age. Now, another thing has to be made apparent. This writer is not preaching. He writes it down. Apocalyptic literature is written literature. It is literature. In this sense, where is it on the board? Right there. It is not sermons primarily. It's something that's written. Now, as he lives, as this writer is writing this down, he also has a number of other perspectives you have to keep in mind. Not only does he believe that God pre-planned this, but because he sort of set it in motion like the time clock thing, you know, as some evolutionistic theologies are, or theologies of evolution. Not only that, he believes that God is up here, and that God has sort of put the angels in charge of ruling the course of history. But not only is it the angels that are there, exerting their force, there are also evil angels, which are called in these places Satans, plural. Satans. And these then have this big struggle. And all of life is a battle between the forces of the evil angels. And poor man gets caught in the middle of it all. The fight between the evil forces, all of which go back to now another figure who's called the devil. Now I want to make it clear that this is very different than the idea of God's operation that you've got in the prophets. Because the prophets don't operate with the angels or with the devil or with Satan or with God as being up here or with anything pre-planned and fixed so that nothing can happen. The prophet is the prophet Jeremiah. And he is preaching not about the destruction of the world, but about the people of God who've gone wrong. And he understands what he's saying. And he's at them and he's saying, look, repent, change, and God will not bring the doom and the destruction upon these people that he's threatened. He operates with the idea that things can change, that repentance can change the course of history, that the word of the prophet is powerful and does things. This is his perspective. And it's very different than the perspective of the apocalyptist, who sees everything foreplanned, foreordained, and fixed. You see? Now, a lot of other things that we could talk about in this difference here. The question for you is, one question for you is, where do you fit in? Are you primarily oriented to the apocalyptic way, where you operate with the devil, with Satan's, with the end of the world as this cataclysmic change? Or do you operate more as the prophets do in your life and in your beliefs and in your thinking? I put these on the board, one to help you understand what apocalyptic is and how it is something new in the intertestamental period. It is an additional element in the religion of the Jews, something that entered. what we call the dualism, the battle between the devil and God. You see, there is no place in the Old Testament where the devil is mentioned as such. We have three references to a name, Satan, but he is in no sense in the Old Testament the source of evil. He is simply a man who stands, or a being rather, who stands in the heavenly council of God and makes certain accusations. But nowhere in the Old Testament is it ever said that the devil is the source of evil. So that this pole between the God who is good and the source of evil being another being is never there. You show me a passage, and I'll be happy to concede. Change my thinking at this point. The only way that you can see it being there is to operate from the New Testament and say, well, I understand certain of these passages in this way. And that's a different perspective. All right?
Even the creation story?
Even the creation story. I mean, anywhere. I think it's questioning.
Why just in referring to the fall of man and the implementation of the...
All right, what about the story of Genesis about the snake and so on? The fall of man. Right, does the story of Genesis 3 ever mention the devil?
No.
No. Never says the devil. Not mentioned at all. And if you identify the devil with the snake, that of course is not something that's in the text, that's something that you've added. It's something that may have added on the basis of what you believe from the New Testament, but it's not in the Old Testament, and it's not part of this prophetic position and teaching that is there. Then you have to say that the writer was using symbols with a hidden meaning that he didn't know about, and that you can find out from later. You see? You getting it? All right. Then the apocalyptic writer, when he starts talking about the future and all the rest of it, he starts talking in these symbols. He uses very bizarre symbols sometimes. Animal symbols especially. Number symbols. The stars mean something. Horoscope business is, of course, right in the kind of line that would fit him and suit him. And so I'm going to ask you to look at one passage now of Daniel, Daniel chapter 7, and see whether you can't catch the symbolism and the sequence of the whole thing and get the idea of what apocalyptic does. Daniel chapter 7. This is perhaps the heart of Daniel and the most important chapter of Daniel. And we may not finish it, but we'll start. Or maybe I should ask you any questions about my initial definition of what apocalyptic is.
Is it that deeply divided?
Between the two? There is a period of transition from this one to this one. A man like Ezekiel is sort of in the transition period, and then when you get into right before the time of Christ, you are completely, almost completely in this position.
Well, now, is it possible for people to be...
And the question is whether or not the New Testament is captures part of both. Matthew 24 and 25.
You've got plenty of props, the prophetic...
Yes, that's right. And the question is, although I make this antithesis, I'm sure that in your life there is probably a balance of part of both. And I'm not denying this possibility. But I want you to see that there's a very definite historical transition from this position to this one in the intertestamental period. And this was dominant all through the intertestamental, well, from about the second, especially the third, second, and first century before Christ. This was the big thing. And the book of Revelation is completely this position. Number one, the apocalyptic. The book of Revelation is a classic in apocalyptic symbols. And you read it, you say, well, what do all these symbols mean? What is the hidden mystery, the meaning behind them all? Yes?
There's quite a relationship between the apocalyptic and Gnosticism.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to bring in another obtuse religion. Probably having enough difficulty just to understand apocalyptic at this point, you know, and the distinction between the two. So I won't bring in Gnosticism, which is really a early Christian problem rather than a pre-intertestamental one. Although I agree with you. All right. Chapter 7 for about 10 minutes. Daniel had dreams and visions. 7 verse 1. Well, there's the first part of it. We are right in the middle of what is typically apocalyptic, namely dreams and visions. So you have a dream, and like the psychologist or psychiatrist, you've got to interpret it. Right? So you have to start, you have a vision, and the vision is full of symbols and has to be interpreted. Then he wrote down. Notice he wrote down. The prophets never say that. I got a sermon and I got an inspiration and I wrote it down. I never write it down. The only time that Jeremiah ever wrote something down, and I know Jeremiah very well, is when he had a letter that he had to write because God had said, you can't, Brother Joachim had persecuted him. There was no way of him getting to the king, so he had to get to the king via a letter through Baruch. You see? If he had gone there, he would have been murdered on the spot. He was in the condemnation. So he has to write. Well, that's the only time. And or one other time he writes a letter because he's going to the exiles and he can't preach there, he can't get there. But whenever he is in a living situation, he doesn't write. And he doesn't say, I had a vision and I wrote. But here is typically apocalyptic. I had a vision and I wrote it down. And all everything. Verse 2. I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Who remembers from last week what the great sea is all about? What is the great sea?
Evil.
Right? It's a symbol of the forces of chaos and of evil at the beginning of time. Now, verse 3. And four great beasts came out of the sea. Well, I'm going to scrap this off. We ought to get this picture quite clear. He has a vision, and now there are four beasts that come out of the sea. In a sense, they are evil beasts because they come out of that which is a symbol of chaos and of evil. What? The first beast that he sees is a lion, and it has eagle's wings. First beast is a lion. And so immediately you can see we are dealing with symbols. The lion is must symbolize something, must mean something, and it's not an ordinary lion because it's got wings of an eagle. So there's another dimension to this lion. And then I looked, and his wings were plucked off, which means that it can't fly anymore, it can't operate anymore. It was lifted up from the ground and made to stand upon 2 feet like a man. You say, well, what on earth does that mean? And here we have to go back to a story earlier in Daniel to understand it. And the mind of a man was given to it. That's strange stuff, isn't it? All right, we'll get the interpretation later. Two, there's a bear. See, a bear, and this bear does some strange things too. It's raised up on one side. It apparently is a short-legged bear on one side. And it has three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. All right, so you've got the picture of the second animal he sees. And then there was a command given to it, eat much flesh. So apparently this animal is one who is voracious. It's always eating, it's always consuming, it's always doing something that is not very nice. Verse 6, then I looked and saw a leopard, and the leopard had four wings. So the third animal is a leopard. And the four wings, of course, you could very easily guess what the four wings represent. That he can spread out in all four directions, he can move in all four directions. And you'll understand how that fits when we get to the interpretation. And then comes the fourth beast. Doesn't give him a name. At all. Number four, the fourth beast. Well, look at this guy. Beautiful animal. Both beasts exceedingly strong and dreadful, and he had great iron teeth. Devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue. Who's the residue? That's, of course, the people of God. Well, that's interpreting already. The residue. And then it had 10 horns. Well, now suddenly we're operating on a new dimension. There are 10 horns now. All right? You have to ask the question, what do the horns mean? So they symbolize something, too, in this bizarre background here. And then there came up a little horn. A little horn, and he broke down 3 other horns. And this horn had the eyes of a man and a mouth that was a bragger. And so you had the little horn. Okay? The big lion, the bear, the leopard, the fourth beast. Now notice as he gets down the line, the more detailed he gets.
Now he's getting to the fourth beast, and he's getting really detailed. He is dealing with this beast that's got 10 horns, and then the 3 horns get broken off, and you get the last of all is the little horn. That's a little bell. Well, I suppose we'll have to stop. Why don't you look now at the rest of chapter 7, as well as the rest of Daniel. And we'll first of all interpret chapter 7 so you get a feel of how apocalyptic operates. With the symbols, with the idea of the end of the age, the plan of history, we'll see it in this.